Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome back to Renee's Heart to Heart. This is Renee. Happy Monday. I hope everybody had a nice holiday weekend. I hope nobody suffered any bruises from Black Friday. Today should be a little safer anyway. Cyber Monday shouldn't get you out in the throngs of crazy people. I promised myself for the month of December that everything we talked about was going to be upbeat and supportive. And then Sunday afternoon, I found a documentary called Valentine Road, and I watched it. And it was very well done. I didn't pay attention to who produced it or who actually filmed the documentary. But it was very informative. It was very real. And it's about a young man, actually two young men, who, in my opinion, got nothing from the adults in their lives. Nothing. And it shows you how important it is for the adults to be involved. Not kind of sort of involved, but really involved. Now, one of these kids had no parents and was in the system. The other of these kids had parents, but one was abusive, and the other, his mother, was addicted to methamphetamines. So both stories are so sad and are so full of mistakes and wrongdoings. Yet one is gone and one is in prison. Neither one of those things should have happened at all. So I'm going to bring Shelley in, but then I'm going to read an article because I want you to get the full gist of this story. Because first I was going to just talk about it, and I thought I'd leave out some important points because I get so incited when I think about this, because very sadly, this is one story, but I think it fits many scenarios that are out there today. So, good morning, Miss Shelley.
Good morning, Rainey.
How are you?
Doing pretty good. Had a nice weekend. I hope you did too.
Yeah, I did. Well, it's been an interesting weekend. I haven't mentioned this yet this morning, but for those of you who don't know, I'm on kind of a vigil. My sister right beneath me is very, very ill, and they're moving her today to hospice care, but Saturday night we didn't think she was going to make that, and yet she rallied again yesterday. I mean, she's not certainly great, but she's at least awake and saw some of her grandchildren yesterday, so today she
you
gets filled with fluids.
Friday?
Yes, she does. She does.
All right, good.
She does.
That
so
means
I
a
suspect,
lot. That helps.
Yeah.
That helps people to be stronger.
Yeah. Well, and every day she asks my niece, you know, when is Renee coming? And Kelly tells her. So I do think this is part of it. So at any rate, that made this weekend one of those kind of weekends. It was kind of up and down. But I did spend Saturday morning with the Golden Girls, which is always light and friendly and full of support and love. So that was nice. And family was around most of the weekend. So, but I watched this documentary on Sunday. And we were going to talk about Social Network, and we were going to talk about a lot of other things this week, and I watched this documentary, and I have to share it with everybody because it personifies everything that we talk about when nobody steps up to the plate. I mean, thousands of people do little things. You know, there was, in this documentary, it was so well done. You could see that there were people, but even the people that did good things didn't do them the right way. You know, I mean, they stepped up and thought that they were being supportive, and they really weren't. They were really making the problem a little bit worse, because if you're going to do some of those things along with your attempt to make things better, there has to be some, like, explanation. There has to be things explained to young people. Well, before I get talking about things that none of you really understand what the hell I'm talking about, I'm going to read this. So, okay. And if you get the chance, if it's on again, I think it was on HBO. It's called Valentine Road. And of all the documentaries I've watched, it seems to be the most honest. You know what I mean? It kind of reminded me of the Bully movie, because they spend a lot of time with the parents, with the friends, with the friends with issues. It was good.
Okay, I'll check that out.
Okay. The murder of Larry King refers to the February 12, 2008 shooting death of Lawrence Larry Phobes King, January 13, 1993 to February 13, 2008. He was 15 years old. He was a gay student at E.O. Green Junior High School in Oxnard, California. He was shot twice by a fellow student. 14-year-old Brandon McInerney, and kept on life support until he died 2 days later. They described the shooting as the most prominent gay bias crime since the 1998 murder of Matthew Shepard, bringing attention to issues of gun violence as well as gender expression and sexual identity of teenagers. Following many delays and change of venue, McInerney's first trial began on July 5, 2011, in the Los Angeles District of Chatsworth. The trial ended on September 1, 2011, when the judge, Charles Campbell, declared a mistrial due to the jury being unable to reach a unanimous verdict. Prosecutors decided to seek a second trial, but dropped the hate crime charge. On November 21, 2011, McInerney pleaded guilty to second-degree murder, voluntary manslaughter, and use of a gun. This plea carries a sentence of 21 years imprisonment without time off for good behavior and avoided the scheduled retrial. He was sentenced on December 19, 2011. So that's the end of the story. This is kind of a background that led up to that day. Larry King was born on January 13, 1993, at the Ventura County Medical Center in Ventura, California. King was adopted at age 2 by Gregory and Dawn King. His biological father had abandoned his wife, and his mother was a drug addict who failed to care for her son properly. King was prescribed medication for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And according to Gregory King, Larry had been diagnosed with reactive attachment disorder, a condition in which a child fails to develop relationships with his or her caregivers. He was also forced to repeat the first grade of schooling. By third grade, King began to be bullied by his fellow students due to his effeminacy and openness about being gay, having come out at 10 years old. At the age of 12, King was placed on probation for theft and vandalism. In November of 2007, he was removed from his adoptive home and placed in a group home and treatment center called Casa Pacifica. After he alleged that his adoptive father was physically abusing him, a charge Gregory King denied. The bullying continued when King transferred to E.O. Green Junior High School in the seventh grade and intensified when he began attending school wearing women's accessories and clothing. High Heels and Makeup in January 2008. King's brother, Rocky, also suffered bullying because of Larry's appearance. The school could not legally stop King from dressing as such because of California anti-discrimination law that prevents gender discrimination. Although teachers at the school thought that his clothing was clearly in violation of school code, which prevents students from wearing clothing considered distracting. The school issued a formal notice to every teacher on January 29, 2008. By email, written by 8th grade assistant principal Sue Parsons. It read in part, "We have a student on campus who has chosen to express his sexuality by wearing makeup. It is his right to do so. Some kids are finding it amusing. Others are bothered by it. As long as it does not cause classroom disruptions, he is within his rights. We are asking that you talk to your students about being civil and non-judgmental. They don't have to like it, but they need to give him his space. We are also asking you watch for possible problems. If you wish to talk further about this, please see me or Joy Epstein." Joy Epstein was one of the school's assistant principals and also openly lesbian. Several teachers and King's father accused Epstein of encouraging Larry's flamboyance as a part of her political agenda. King also taunted boys in the hall, saying, "I know you want me," and was known to make inappropriate comments to boys while they were changing for PE class. However, prosecuting attorneys filed court documents that stated King was not sexually harassing other students in the weeks before the shooting. McKierney and King had been in several verbal altercations described as acrimonious by the prosecutor. I don't even know what acrimonious means. I thought that meant like condescending or something. Brandon David McKierney was born on January 24, 1994 in Ventura, California. His mother, Kendra, had a criminal history and was addicted to methamphetamine. In 1993, Kendra accused her husband of shooting her in the arm with a .45 caliber pistol. In another incident, William McKierney choked his wife almost to unconsciousness after she accused him of stealing ADHD medication from her elder son. He pleaded no contest and served 10 years in jail and 36 months probation on a charge of domestic violence. Between August 2000 and February 2001, William McKierney had contacted Child Protective Services at least 5 times about concerns of his son living with his mother. In 2001, he filed a restraining order against Kendra, and in 2004, Brandon was placed in the custody of his father, as his mother had entered a drug rehabilitation program. In 2008, Newsweek reported that a day or two before the shooting, King walked onto the basketball court in the middle of a game and asked McKierney to be his Valentine in front of the team, who then made fun of McKierney. Just after lunchtime on February 11th, King passed McKierney in a corridor and called out, "Love you, baby." Later that day, King was seen parading back and forth in high-heeled boots and makeup in front of McKierney. According to a teacher, a group of boys were laughing at McKierney, who was getting visibly upset, and assistant principal Joy Epstein, noticing McKierney's reaction, wagged her finger at him. Then McKierney endured teasing because of the incident. He attempted to recruit other students to assault King, but no one expressed interest. He then told one of King's friends to say goodbye to him because she would never see him again. On the morning of February 12, 2008, McKierney was witnessed repeatedly looking at King during a class in a computer laboratory. At approximately 8:15 a.m. local time, McKierney drew from his backpack a .22 caliber revolver belonging to relatives and shot King twice in the back of the head. Following the shooting, McKierney tossed the handgun to the floor and walked from the classroom. He was apprehended by police about 7 minutes later and 5 blocks away from the school campus. King was transported to St. John's Regional Medical Center, where he was listed in serious condition. He was declared brain dead on February 13th, but was kept on life support for 2 days so that his organs could be donated. Since McKierney has refused to speak to investigators, the motive for the shooting remains unclear. According to Police Chief John Crombatch, it's pretty clear our suspect was focused on this victim and what he planned to do. Vigils and marches were organized across the United States following King's death. Sympathies for King have been expressed by numerous people, including Judy Shepard, Human Rights Campaign, President Joe Salmanese, Senator Hillary Clinton, and a television hostess, Ellen DeGeneres. 1,000 students in the, I don't even know how to say this name of this school, Hunim School District, where E.O. Green is located, marched to pay tribute to King on February 16, 2008, 4 days after the shooting. A new diversity education bill was introduced on behalf of King in California Assemblyman Mike Ng saying, "We need to teach young people that there's a curriculum called tolerance education that should be in every school. We should teach young people that diversity is not something to be assaulted, but diversity is something that needs to be embraced because diversity makes California the great state that it is." The bill would require mandatory classes on diversity and tolerance in California school districts. A local vigil in Ventura, California was organized 1 year after King's death, the Day of Silence for 2008, which is intended to protest LGBT harassment and occurred on April 25th, especially dedicated to King. King's father, Greg, is unconvinced his adopted son was gay, as Larry had only recently told them he was actually bisexual. Greg believes that Larry was sexually harassing McKierney and has expressed concern that Larry is being made a poster child for gay rights issues. Teachers also showed sympathy for McKierney. "We failed Brandon," a teacher said. "We didn't know the bullying was coming from the other side. Larry was pushing as hard as he could because he liked the attention. Hundreds of children from the school have signed a petition requesting that McKierney be tried as a juvenile." In August 2008, King's family filed a claim against D.O. Green Junior High School at Ventura County Superior Court, alleging that the school's allowing King to wear makeup and feminine clothing was a factor leading to his death. According to the California Attorney General's office, however, the school could not legally have stopped King from wearing girls' clothes because state law prevents gender discrimination. According to a Newsweek article published on July 19, 2008, some teachers at E.O. Green also allege that assistant principal Joy Epstein was encouraging King's flamboyance to help further an agenda. When Epstein was later promoted to principal in another local public school, King's father described it as a slap in the face of my family. The superintendent, Jerry Dannenberg, stated that the promotion was given because she was the most qualified person for the new principal job. In February of 2008, McKierney's lawyer, William Quest, was considering a change of venue. Judge Douglas Daly of the Ventura County Superior Court ruled that McKierney would stand trial as an adult, with the decision being appealed. On August 7, 2008, in the same court, McKierney pleaded not guilty to premeditated murder and a hate crime. A preliminary hearing was set for September 23rd, which had been rescheduled for October of 2008. In September of 2008, the court appointed Willard Wicksell, a lawyer from Venturia, guardian ad litem for McKierney. Previously, McKierney's family took steps to fire his lawyer, William Quest, of the Public Defender's Office, and hire the United Defense Group, a criminal defense law group from Los Angeles. However, the Public Defender's Office filed a petition stating that United Defense Group might not have McKierney's best interest in mind. In October, after the court received a report from the appointed guardian ad litem, and the court determined that the defendant had not been coerced into changing representation and knew what he was doing, the Ventura County Superior Court allowed McKierney to fire his public defender and the public defender's office and hire the United Defense Group together with attorney Robin Bramson as his attorneys. The court also denied a motion to gag the defendant's former representatives from the public defender's office from speaking about the case, especially to the media. In 2008, December of 2008, the Ventura County Superior Court ruled that McKierney, after being evaluated by a psychiatrist and psychologist, was competent to stand trial. That same day, Scott S. Whippert of the United Defense Group filed a legal motion for discovery, asking the court to order the district attorney to provide documents to uncover whether prosecutors exercised discretion in sending McKierney's case to the adult court system. At the end of December, Judge Rebecca Riley denied the motion, stating that there was no evidence of abuse in discretion in transferring the information. On February of 2009, there was another hearing. You know, this gets pretty repetitious. It's all legal jargon. And this one group that they brought in, they interviewed them in the movie. And they were really pro-Brandon. They felt that Brandon had really been, you know, dropped. There was lots of interviews with one of his older brothers who said that he was the only child that got left with the father. And often he would come to school with a bloody nose or a black eye or a busted lip, and that his dad was the one responsible for that abuse. So, and many, through the documentary, many pictures of how messed up his mom would be. And when she finally got clean, she couldn't, you know, her record and everything, it didn't talk about her really trying to get him back, but she tried to be part of his life, and that wasn't working. And the older brother tried to be part of his life, and I guess they were close, but that was it. So he was pretty much standing alone, just like this other kid, although I will say that in the documentary, Larry seemed to have a lot more friends than Brandon did, a lot more friends, a lot more people that could sympathize and empathize with what was going on with him. But when the trial finally came to the court, the half-brother of McKierney, James, was admonished by Judge Campbell because it was overheard that Bing went to the jury outside of the courtroom and addressed them. He said, "The fate of my brother is in your hands." Bing was then banned from the courtroom unless he was summoned to testify. The prosecutor depicted McKierney as a popular teenager who was skilled in martial arts and firing guns, as well as being a white supremacist. She went on to describe King as a small guy who had often been picked on, saying King wore high-heeled boots, makeup, and jewelry, along with his school uniform to the school. McKierney's attorney described King as an aggressor, saying he often was sexually aggressive and made inappropriate remarks, provoking McKierney. Witnesses who were students and classmates of McKierney's testified. In July, one witness said that King told her he had changed his name to Letitia. Another witness said many students made fun of King and called him offensive names behind his back when he came to school wearing makeup and jewelry. A few of the witnesses said that they never noticed King making sexual advances towards other students, but that sexual comments he made were just messing with McKierney. The former vice president, Joy Epstein, testified she had discussed King's behavior with other school officials of the school district and decided it was according to the constitutional rights, legitimate for King to wear what he wanted unless it violated the school dress code. Joy Epstein said high heel boots, makeup, and jewelry were all allowed according to the Oxnard school dress policy. She and another administrator within the district said that the school must protect the students' civil and equal rights. Another teacher testified that pupils had told her King would seek them out and followed them into the bathroom, behavior she considered to be sexual harassment. She was told by Epstein the school could do nothing about the behavior. The jury was shown footage of a video in which McKierney was fighting in the Venturi County Juvenile Hall, where he currently lives. One of the corrections officers testified that the defendant was a good kid in the honors program for good behavior and had relationships with people of different backgrounds and origins. He said that within the juvenile hall environment, fighting was a routine occurrence and that McKierney was not prone to violence, as the prosecution alleged. An English teacher had testified that she had counseled King and told him he should not wear attention-getting clothing if he did not want to receive negative attention. She also gave the teen, who was exploring his sexual and or gender identity, a strapless green chiffon gown. She meant for him to wear it outside of school. A photo was shown of Larry King holding up the dress, and many people in the courtroom were crying. Greg King, Larry's father, became upset and gathered his family to leave, but before doing so, Dawn King, Larry's mother, swore at Boldrin's 13-year-old daughter and a relative. The judge later barred Dawn King from the remainder of the trial. Because the school administrators were allowing King to wear whatever he wanted as long as he did not violate the dress code, the defense was arguing that this allowed King to sexually harass McKierney. See how convoluted this has become, and you see all of the bad guidance has gotten. The trial ended without a verdict and declared a mistrial by the judge. September of 2011, after the jury reported that they were hopelessly deadlocked and unable to reach a unanimous verdict. There were 8 weeks of testimony with almost 100 witnesses, and the jury had been deliberating since August of 2011. The jury had taken 4 votes, and the last vote was split between 7 jurors voting for voluntary manslaughter and 5 jurors voting for first-degree or second-degree murder. On September 2nd, the district attorney's office announced that they intended to retry McKierney, and a hearing was scheduled for October 5th, 2011. For that second trial, the prosecutors dropped the hate crime charge. On November 21st, however, McKierney pleaded guilty to second-degree murder, voluntary manslaughter, and use of a firearm. He will receive 21 years behind bars, with no credit given for time served prior to the trial, and no credit will be given for good behavior. He will initially serve his sentence in a juvenile facility and then be transferred to prison upon turning 18. So, in the documentary that I watched, they interviewed at length 6 of the jurors. And so everybody gets the gist of this. The jurors, even though they had some empathy for Larry, the young man that was killed, they also had some pretty heavy empathy for Brandon. And they even wore bracelets and band together to say, you know, this, he deserved to be punished, but he did not deserve to be, you know, have his whole life taken away. And actually, in the documentary, they kind of celebrated the fact that he would only get 21 years. So he will be, like, 21, and he must be 16 by the time this happens. So he'll be, like, 37 years old when he comes out.
Wow.
But what got me, Shelley, what really floored me, is if you watch the documentary, it's just like when we watch the Bully movie. It's, you see so many adults making such big mistakes. The teacher that gave him the gown, by the way, she thought that she was friending him. She thought, you could tell. I mean, she had girls of her own, and she was trying to make this kid accept himself and not feel like an outcast. We can both understand that. We've talked about that on the show.
Right.
We've talked about that personally. But on the same token, even when you have a kid that isn't struggling with their gender or with their sexuality, but likes to, you know, like be, you know, one side of their head is purple, the other side of their head is green, and they've got piercings all over their body. Unless they stay with the kids that dig that stuff, they're going to be ridiculed. They're going to be picked on. So guidance is almost imperative. I thought that the memo sent out to the teachers from the principal was articulate and true. But again, what's a memo? Did everybody read it? Did everybody get it? There should have been a big meeting. There should
What I don't understand is why the parents were blaming the school when they're sending him to school. I mean, why wasn't it the parents' responsibility to not allow him to dress like that? Why are they blaming the school for it?
I
missed that part.
I never saw the parents in the documentary. The people.
Do you understand
that,
my point? I mean, they're suing the school, saying, you know, you let him. Well, you let him dress like that too, and you're his parents. You have more authority over him than the school does.
But why wasn't it? He didn't live with his parents, honey. He lived in Casa Pacifica, which is like a group home for kids that don't have any place to go. The King family adopted him, and they couldn't deal with him.
Oh, okay.
For the notoriety, for the attention, whatever. But they were not supporting him. He had one older guy that was at the home, and he talked frequently. They would go to clips of talking about him, and he even tattooed on his arm Larry and the date that Larry was killed, because he felt, and he was a young straight man. I'm going to guess he was, I don't know, 19, 20 years old, and he stayed involved with Casa Pacifica because it was all he ever knew as well, another child that, you know, grew up with no parents, and he loved this place. And then there were several people that they interviewed that had issues that nobody wanted, and they ended up at this, for all intents and purposes, an orphanage. They never call it that, but that's what it was. And but it's, again, a story about failed adults. Nobody, I mean, every now and then somebody does something, but this went on for a long time, almost 2 years.
Wow.
And
the fact
that
Brandon in the school noticeably, you know, beaten up or being abused by his father, why didn't anybody step in with CPS? You know,
well,
but was that obvious?
According to the stepbrother, he talked about that at length. He said nobody ever did anything. Brandon would go to school, you know, with his one. I guess one time he was like, he was only 14 when this happened, and about 6 months before this happened, he'd never done drugs. He'd never done anything, according to his stepbrother. Now you can take that with a grain of salt. It's irrelevant anyway. But I guess one day, the father found out that he had had a beer with some of his friends, and he cold-cocked him right in the face. And when he did that, he broke his nose or something, and I guess he was a mess. Nobody said anything. Oh, what happened? Oh, okay, I fell. Oh, okay. And that was the extent of it. Now, again, a lot of this is because the water gets too deep, and people really don't know what to do. I get that. But if you're an adult and if you're in a place that you're supposed to be watching these kids, you know, I don't understand. I really, really don't understand. And then when everybody stands up and says, oh, my God, yeah, they're just going to hell in a handbasket. Well, you know, you made the basket, for God's sakes. We made the basket.
That's right.
So, but this, when you talk about two senseless, totally and completely senseless, one kid is gone completely. I mean, you know, is no longer with us, and the other kid is going to spend the most, really, the most important years of his life, 14 to, what did I say, 37, something like that, behind bars. For what? Because here's something else that I know about homosexuality when it is just a preference. I mean, if I can call it that. They don't usually pay any attention to straight people because they don't want that kind of attention. And this, for me, and the pictures of him, he's adorable, but he starts wearing the big fancy eyelashes to school and lipstick and dangly earrings and everything, and he's cute. He's cute as a button. They didn't show any pictures of him really dressed in girls' clothing, but they did show some close-ups of him with the makeup on. And he had a couple of friends. There was two girls that were gay, and they were a couple. And the school addressed them by saying, "We understand that you care about each other, but you must behave yourselves in school. Don't draw attention to your relationship to the point where you make other people uncomfortable." Now, I don't know if that's the perfect advice, but it was something. You know, it was something so that they were not receiving any of this, this bad attention. Larry did bring it on himself. Larry did entice somebody who was afraid everybody else was going to think he was participating in some kind of a relationship like that. And there was a reason for that. That I would be more concerned about than the fact that he wanted to dress up in girls' clothes. You see where I'm going with that?
Well, yeah, because it was almost like he didn't realize he was doing it. He was doing it to just be flamboyant, you know. But he was picking somebody out that was emotionally unstable and that was literally a ticking time bomb. If anybody had been aware or it took the time to look at Brandon and the type of life he was coming from, he was, you know, he wasn't a bullier. He was actually being bullied by Larry when you come down to it, because he became the butt of ridicule at the school. And instead of making a joke out of it and saying, "Hey, you know, I'm so desirable, even guys think I'm cute," you know, he could have, if he had an appropriate self-esteem and felt good about himself, he wouldn't have been threatened by it. But he was so freaked out that somebody else would think he was gay also, and he already had all this other anger in him. It came to a head and boiled over. And what a tragedy, because it could have absolutely been prevented if somebody had just taken 2 seconds to say, "Oh wow, this is a glass of water at the edge of a table that's about ready to get knocked off by somebody. I better pull it into a safe place." But everybody just watched it until somebody came in and they all knocked it off the table.
Yep. Well, I when I watched the documentary, I thought to myself, what would I do? I always think like that, you know, what would I say, what would I do? And it is not an easy thing to look at, to figure out what words of wisdom you can conjure up to make somebody understand that they're putting themselves in a bad place. But it didn't seem like through the whole documentary that they understood, that the teachers were aware of this this singling out of Brandon by Larry. There was never any conversation about, "Oh yeah, we knew that he was messing with Brandon," or "Yeah." I don't think the kids knew it. His friends knew it. The Valentine thing was something that they decided to do in the school. You were supposed to make a Valentine and take it to the person that you felt that way about and present it to them. And he did that to Brandon on the basketball court in front of all the other stocks with a Valentine. And imagine, especially somebody who's suffering the way Brandon was suffering, I can just feel the heat rising up in his face and the embarrassment and the everything he must have felt was overwhelming. But it's
right.
Nobody addressed Brandon. Nobody addressed the black eyes or any of that kind of turmoil. Nobody all the way up through school in a relatively small town addressed the fact that he's been separated from his mother and his other two brothers, and that he's living with a man that might be abusing him. None of that stuff was ever addressed in the documentary. Whether somebody did something about it or anybody counseled him on that was never shown in the documentary. So that.
And how long was it after the Valentine was presented to him on the basketball court did the shooting take place?
I think like 2 days.
Yeah. That pushed him over the edge. Wow.
14th February, so it was something, I can't remember the exact date, but something in, and I'm back on my dashboard, I can look. But
I think it was 2 days. I think it was. But, and you think about it, obviously killing somebody is wrong, but this kid wasn't thinking right. He was so devastated by what Larry did to him. And Larry was doing it either as a goof or maybe he really was attracted to him. Who knows? But the bottom line is that's inappropriate, okay? Even if a guy liked a girl to do that, unless he knew that the girl liked him, you know, it could be, I mean, it was over the line. It would have been different if it was a couple, even guys that knew they cared about each other. Then it becomes romantic, you know, even among teenagers, you know. You always see these, on the Jumbotron at a baseball game, and you see a guy asking a girl to marry him, you know. Well, what if a guy was next to a girl who didn't even know him and he did that? It could be embarrassing or humiliating, you know, and here you're dealing with a kid who's just been made a spectacle of in the most threatening way possible because it threatens his sexuality. Now he's worried that the rest of the school thinks he is, you know, homophobia among heterosexual men is an issue. And it can make them very angry. And
a big one.
Larry really pushed all the wrong buttons in Brendan, unfortunately, and nobody was there to guide him that that's what he was doing, that he actually created this monster.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. That's what I feel like is the bigger issue here. The issue that was being addressed by all the teachers was his flamboyancy and his blatantly putting everything in everybody's face, and the fact that he was trying to be a girl. However, if you have somebody that does things that brings them that kind of I don't think anybody should hide it. I think that's unhealthy as well. But I think something has to be examined when you see somebody who, like, just continually pushes the buttons of someone else. I mean, there was
right. No,
they were never even friends. You know, he just picked this kid, and the one girlfriend that was a couple, the two girls that were a couple, the one girlfriend said, he couldn't help himself. He just liked Brandon. And I thought to myself, you know, I get that part of it. I mean, you know, that makes sense to me. But why wasn't that some of the information that the teachers dealt with instead of just, you know, you're getting all these comments and you're getting all this ridicule and they were more concerned, and I'm sorry I have to say this, but they were more concerned about how they were going to look at the end of the day. Every principal, everybody. They followed procedure to the best of their ability, but the only one that put out anything extra to show support or try to show this young boy, Larry, that she cared about him regardless of what was going on in his life, you could see that that's what she was trying to do. And although some of her the gown and all that stuff was a little over the top, and there should have been more. I mean, she said to him, you know, this is for your private use. This is not for you to wear to school. This is not proper attire for school, but this is something. And he was so pleased with it. And you saw in, or you heard me say in the courtroom when they showed that picture of him standing there with this gown, a whole bunch of the people in the courtroom started crying because people get, I think people feel for kids like that, and they it tugs at their heartstrings because they realize that he's got nobody, and now he's got this challenge to deal with as well. And yet, nobody addressed his what's the word I'm looking for? He did it on purpose.
Well, his flamboyance. I mean, that's what it is, because, you know, it's a lot of, you know, a lot of teenagers that become aware that they're gay, they're afraid of saying it. He wasn't afraid. He was totally okay with who he was, very flamboyant. You know, he's like these, you know, you ever see these stage performers that are mm-hmm. that are gay or cross dressers or these women impersonators and things like that, and you see them off camera, oh my God, they're like so over the top. But it's what makes them a good performer, because they're over the top in their personality. I actually knew a gay man. He was a tall, skinny black guy. He was a female impersonator at a show. And when I first met him, I didn't realize he was a guy. He was actually a friend of a friend. And, mm-hmm. and I could see the friend laughing because I'm talking to this woman. And I'm like, you know, like, what is going on? And then they finally told me this was a guy I was talking to. And I cracked up laughing. I mean, he was sweet. But he was so freaking flamboyant. He was even flamboyant for a woman, but I thought because he was she was a performer when I first met her, I thought that's where the flamboyance was coming from. Then when I found out that he was a gay crossdresser, that really explained more the flamboyance. But there's something in them, whatever is in their genetic makeup and their hormone makeup that makes them black flamboyant does push them over the top. And that's why at a younger age, because I'm sure they all realize that young, like you said, they would need guidance saying, look, it's totally okay to be like that. There's actually professions you can go into where that flamboyance is actually going to help you be successful. But in a school setting, you know, you don't want to stand out that much because you could make people, you know, kids aren't that tolerant yet. You know, you're not out in the world where people are going to be accepting of that. Let's tone it down a little bit. And when you get a little bit older, then go for it. We'll even get you some contacts and stuff. You know, so don't make them feel bad, but make them be reasonable. Make them, you know, work it when it's going to work for them and not use it in a way that's going to be turning people off. And that's where he lacked guidance, obviously.
Well, I mean, like I said before, I agree with all that, and I understand the fact that a lot of times people pursue people that don't feel the same way about them and all that kind of stuff. But you, as a rule, don't get their attention by embarrassing them. And right. And that's really what this little boy was doing. I mean, he was, like, really, really pushing his buttons. And if you really care about somebody, and this is what I think, while you've been talking, I've been thinking about it too, and I thought to myself, how would I advise him? I would say, maybe it would be better if you just tried to become friends with Brian as a young man, you know, and not push the other side of you in his face and make him uncomfortable, because now you'll never get to be friends with him because he doesn't know what to do with your attention. And
right.
I would feel like that would open a door, because I think it became kind of a game for him. And because he's a kid that's already been shoved around and thrown out and not wanted and all the other stuff that happened to him in his lifetime, the fact that he has scars that are making him have bad behavior is not shocking, for sure. And the
right.
same with Brandon, you know.
Right.
But that's what I'm saying. Both of them, the guidance sucked. I want to say that whenever you have a kid that is acting so out of control. Now, that's lack of control because it just is. It just shows that you cannot, you don't have the kind of control over your own behavior that you need to have. And there's a lot of us out there like that. And there's a lot of reasons for it. And often it has to do with some disconnections. And this Larry was a twin. And his twin brother was kept by the adoptive parents. And they didn't keep Larry. So there's cut one.
Now,
and,
was also gay?
Huh?
I don't remember. Did they say the twin was also gay?
No, the twin is, they don't really even talk about the twin. I saw that in the documentary. In the paper I just read today, they don't really talk about, they also don't talk too much about why he was adopted. I guess he and the brother were born to somebody and, even in the documentary, I don't remember what they said happened to his real mother, but they never talked about her, or his real father, or if they knew who his father was. But the King family were his adoptive parents, but they let him go. And then they showed up again in court, like I said, for the notoriety and the attention, it appears as though. But again, if you've got the other Brandon, they showed pictures in the documentary that made him look just like any movie you've ever watched about a white supremacist. They made him look that way, like you would not believe. Mean look in his, stern look on his face. His head is shaved, not bald, but very short, like a army do. And he has this expression on his face that's kind of scary. And yet, when they showed some of the videos later, when he's talking with the cops the day that it happens, he says, "I don't know why I did it. I just couldn't take it anymore." And the cop said, "Well," he said, "if you're lucky, he won't die." And he said, "Yeah, I hope he doesn't die." And then they did take him off life support, and he succumbed. But another thing that I think somebody, a psychologist or a psychiatrist, might do something with was the fact that he didn't shoot him face on. He shot him in the back of his head. And it seems like I've read about things like that, that there's something about somebody who takes the life of someone, not in a big fight where somebody shoots you as you're running away, but he took aim at the back of his head and shot him. So I think that says something, too. I'm not sure exactly what, but I think it says something.
But a lot of times they say if you shoot somebody, like, in the face, or if you mutilate the face in any way, that it generally is personal. So this wasn't personal. It was he was trying to stop the source of ridicule, but he didn't actually hate the kid, which is surprising. And that's kind of corroborated by the fact that what he said to the police officer is, "I hope he doesn't die." In other words, he had a disconnect, like you said. You were talking about this the other day. He absolutely had a disconnect. He was trying to stop a situation he was in that he couldn't handle anymore. But once that incident was over and he's on the other side of what he just did, then all of a sudden he started feeling remorse. And that's actually kind of exceptional that he would have gone there that quickly. But you see that a lot when people fight with each other, and then all of a sudden when everything calms down, they're sitting there going, "Oh, my God, why did I say half the things I did?" Or if it got physical, and then you're sitting there going, and then everybody feels embarrassed, if it came to fisticuffs or something, people that would normally not go there. But in the heat of a moment, sometimes they just become so agitated, but they always regret it. Once everything calms down, they always regret. They regret what they say. They regret if they lost their temper and actually hit another person. And apparently, it's what happened to him. It boiled over. He responded, by shooting this kid, or reacted by shooting this kid, and then instantly regretted it once that boiling over happened and he got his senses back about him. That's really a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, acrimony, I sort of knew what it meant, but I wasn't positive. Acrimonious means, what do you call it? That's another A word. Animosity. When you speak to somebody with acrimony, it means you have animosity towards them. So it's animosity in speech. So acrimony is specifically animosity in speech. So I kind of knew what it meant, but I didn't know how to describe it, so I looked it up while you were going.
Good, because that makes sense. Well, you know, on that note, though, that's why we need to have tougher gun laws, because of what you just summarized, the fact that we so often, if you'll forgive the pun, shoot from the hip, and if there's a gun in our hand, then it's all over. And losing our tempers or being at a point where you think you just have to stop this where you stand, a gun absolutely positively does that. And I think that's why the gun laws, and I don't know the answer to that, by the way, and I probably don't want to get into that conversation with anybody because I don't have anything that makes sense to me to even explain to somebody about gun laws. I like the fact that we can have guns to protect ourselves and our loved ones. I like the fact that our armed forces and all of the people who protect us can have guns. I like the fact that there's so many hunters up north that still feed their families with game that they hunt for and kill with a gun. All of those things make sense to me, but the part that doesn't make sense to me is the gun in the hands of somebody who is not well, not in charge of their faculties and things like that is a big issue for me. And I don't think there is any real fix to it. We're almost out of time, but I do want to say a couple little things. You all remember last week when I told you about a friend whose son had a severe asthma attack?
Yes.
He is getting better. It's been kind of a tough road for them. They found a hole in one of his lungs, and they have him gently being taken out of the coma, and there seems to be good brain activity and things like that. So the word is that he's getting better, so keep the prayers and the good energy coming towards him, please. He's 13 years old, and the love of his family's life. So I want to make sure everybody remembers him today. And I also want to say thank you for last Thursday. I think I mentioned this on Friday, but I want to say it again. Last Thursday was nice having everybody talk about what they were grateful for. That was a beautiful show. And I will be here tomorrow morning, Shelley and I, but as I explained last week, I leave Thursday night for upstate New York to be with my sister, with my other siblings, and I won't be back until the following Tuesday. So we won't be back on the show after this Thursday until next Wednesday, so everybody knows that. And I'm participating in a very special thing. It's called the Green Sober House. And I am all about spreading the word about this. This is a transitional house for women who are clean and sober and have gone through the process but would like to make the transition back into their life in a serene, supportive, comfortable place. If you are that person, you are welcome to contact me on my Facebook page, or you may call me on the show. If you contact me on my Facebook page, I will give you my private phone number so that we can talk. Anything else, Shelley? You want to say anything to anybody this morning?
No, I'm good.
How was your not-so-turkey dinner on Saturday?
Oh, it was nice. It was a lot of fun. Both my nieces came over with their families, and my great nieces and nephew, and I sat around talking, telling stories to Cody, who is the AJ in my family. He's so much like AJ. I would love these two little boys to meet each other because I think they'd probably hit it off. They have such adorable personalities. But so he was kind of my sidekick the whole night. It was just nice. It was a lot of fun.
Good. Good. All right. Well, we're off the air, but let's say goodbye and have a great day, everybody, and we'll be back tomorrow morning. God bless.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Shel. Take care, everyone. Have a wonderful day.